On this episode of China Unscripted, the Chinese Communist Party wants to create its own digital currency to compete with Bitcoin. But while Bitcoin keeps users anonymous, the Chinese currency will allow authorities to track everything people buy and sell, and not just in China. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
And once again, our podcast is sponsored by Path of Cha Tea. Tonight, we are drinking an award-winning Alishan Milk Oolong Tea. So that means it's a Taiwanese oolong tea. And you know, it has a really nice aroma.
Cheers.
I love the smell.
It was really great. Shelley's trying to drink the tea, and Matt's trying to cheers her. And like he keeps reaching over, and she's just not having any of it. So cheers to that.
Are you supposed to cheers tea?
No, you're not. I'm a clumsy Westerner.
Well, anyways, I really like Path of Cha because a lot of tea companies will just kind of sell the dregs of a tea. So like there's the nice tea harvest, and then the little pieces that are left over, that gets bundled up and sold
as Lipton.
Cheap. Well, yeah, kind of like Lipton. But Path of Cha uses, you know, only really, it uses the real leaves and, like, no little bits of debris or twigs. Like, you can see with this tea, the nice big leaves that are very characteristic of this tea.
It smells really good, yeah. And it tastes, like, very smooth.
And I enjoy drinking this tea as an alternative to coffee because I can get too jittery between the coffee and the terror of reading about China. So tea is the perfect balance.
I do like this one. It's almost sweet,
mm-hmm.
which is not what I would think of for an oolong.
Oh, oolong has the most variety in terms of flavors and colors of any of the tea types.
So, Chris, where can our listeners buy this award-winning Alishan Milk Oolong Tea?
So if you'd like to try some of this tea or any one of the many other flavors we've tried on the show, go to pathofcha.com/REF=ChinaUnscripted. The link is also below. Get yourself some great tea and help support China Unscripted.
I think I'm going to buy this one. I actually really like, I think this is my favorite so far.
This is a very nice tea. Joining us today is blockchain expert Alex Gladstein. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So, Alex, you are also the chief strategy officer for the Human Rights Foundation, which hosts the Oslo Freedom Forum. And that's actually how we met. So it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, I would say that that's what I am. And then I also happen to be somebody who lectures about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency for Singularity University, as well as just sort of on my own, I do a lot of writing and speaking just about the general topic as it pertains to freedom and human rights around the world.
Well, and that's why we're having you on. We want to kind of get a better sense of how cryptocurrency, and more specifically blockchain, affects human rights around the world. So the Chinese Communist Party seemingly has started to embrace blockchain, calling it a national priority.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard that, my first reaction was like, oh my gosh, what's a blockchain?
Right. Can I dive in?
Please.
Excellent. Okay. So basically, when people talk about blockchain, they talk about a kind of a area of technology that was born in January of 2009 when Satoshi Nakamoto, who's the sort of pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin. We don't know who he, she, they are, but a person or group of people wrote a kind of an academic paper. We call it a white paper at the end of 2008 for a new kind of digital money system that wouldn't require a third party, that wouldn't require a central authority. Very revolutionary and had never been able to be accomplished before. And they unveiled this with a sort of a concept paper at the end of 2008 during the U.S. sort of banking crisis, right? And in January 2009, they actually launched the code. So the open source Bitcoin software came alive at the end of 2009.
And that's when I should have bought Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, you couldn't have at the time because it wasn't worth anything for many months. But basically, yes, that's when we all should have learned about it. And that's the brilliance of it, is that only like kind of the weirdest people learned about it early, which has kind of shaped the whole space since. But basically, you know, people started running the Bitcoin software around the world to play with and experiment with this idea that we could run a money system without anybody in charge.
And so just for clarity, yeah, traditional money systems work. Like, I may give someone money for goods and services, but the U.S. government is sort of backing that currency. They're like that third party you were mentioning.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, Satoshi's revolution was really important for digital money. Gold is something that humans have, of course, used as base layer money for thousands of years. And shares some interesting traits with Bitcoin. So gold is like scarce. To obtain it, you have to like either do a lot of work to get it or pay a lot of money to get it. There's just not that much of it. Interesting factoid is that throughout human history, in any given year, despite technological advances in mining, no more than 2% of new gold is brought into the system. So as our technological abilities like kind of get better, gold gets harder and harder to find because we keep digging it out of the ground or of the sea or whatever. So gold was something that the people behind Bitcoin were seeking to replicate in the digital world. They wanted a scarce asset in the digital world, and they thought that that would be like a really valuable way to run a money system. So the two things that I think we all should think about when we talk about Bitcoin, at least particularly, you know, one is that it has this element that gold shares in terms of scarcity. You can't just like make more of it, and it's very hard to create. You can't just, no government authority can just create it, okay? The second thing is that when we talk about the payment processing, currently in any other digital money system, a central authority does the processing. So for example, Visa, perhaps your bank, PayPal, there's like a third party between you and the person you're paying that like processes the transaction. They could freeze it, they could surveil it, they could censor it, etc., right? In Bitcoin, there is no authority that processes the transaction. Instead, it's a global competition of people who are competing to process your transaction. This is a process called Bitcoin mining. And this is kind of what makes it so special. Not only is it scarce, but it's also censorship resistant and decentralized. So for people who kind of properly understood it early on, it was really exciting, but it was a tiny little fraction of people on the internet for many years. And it really wasn't a threat to anyone. And that's kind of largely why it was left alone. It's kind of like often referred to as like a kind of the virgin birth or whatever, like this will never happen again. No one else is going to come up with a money system and it be allowed to kind of organically just kind of disseminate and grow without authorities paying attention. It was a one-time shot. And thankfully, whoever coded Bitcoin really knocked it out of the park. So in the Bitcoin white paper, the word blockchain is not even mentioned. But as more interest grew in Bitcoin and as the value of it grew from a cent to 10 cents to a dollar to $10 to $100, et cetera, it's now, you know, whatever it is, $9,000. A lot of people started to become interested in it, right? Of course, as you see an asset grow in price, you're like, what's going on here? And, you know, part of Bitcoin, I would say, is something that we could call a blockchain. I would say, generally speaking, there's like four really important technology parts inside Bitcoin that make it work. You have a peer-to-peer network, which is kind of like BitTorrent, or, you know, many other projects like that. You have public key cryptography, which has been around for decades. You have this sort of distributed ledger, this blockchain, which is just sort of like a chain of records that are time-stamped and distributed around instead of having one authority do it. And then the most important part of Bitcoin, the thing that really makes it work, is called proof of work, or Nakamoto consensus, which is like the way that the records are updated. Instead of an authority doing it, it's, again, a global competition. So all of this came together in a really magical way, and that's why Bitcoin is like a fairly incredible innovation. I think it's similarly important to like the printing press or the internet, in that eventually it's going to separate money from state.
That would be a big deal.
It already has happened. It's already happened. It's just, you know, we're sort of at the beginning. But again, this like drew a lot of attention and interest from people because of the rise in price of the asset. So what ended up kind of coalescing was something we call like the blockchain industry. So these are people who looked at Bitcoin and they were like, ooh, this is cool because it's going to make me a lot of money, or maybe it could make me a lot of money. But I don't really like certain aspects of it. I don't like that I can't control it. I don't like that, you know, criminals could use it. I don't like that, you know, it's not compliant with know your customer and anti-money laundering laws. So let's actually take Bitcoin and kind of neuter it. Let's like take it and sort of emasculate it. Let's take it and like remove the interesting parts of it, but kind of copy the blockchain idea and use it for other stuff. And this has been done in all kinds of industries without a whole lot of like effectiveness, meaning there's not really a there. When you remove the distributed ledger blockchain piece out of those four technologies I described that make Bitcoin interesting, it becomes a lot less interesting on its own. But it hasn't stopped companies ranging from Microsoft to IBM from creating these like corporate blockchains. And it hasn't stopped a whole bunch of people from like minting their own Bitcoin-esque digital currencies, which, you know, honestly just aren't as interesting as Bitcoin because they're not scarce and they're not decentralized. But it has created a huge industry, and the Chinese government saw that. And the Chinese government knows that Bitcoin is not something it wants to tangle with. But rather than try to ban it outright, which would obviously create a huge black market and like cause a lot of intrigue, it's decided to kind of co-opt Bitcoin, create a competitor that it can control. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about, the digital yuan. But this is something that's been in the works for a while. The Chinese government has like over time, like banned and kind of put restrictions in place in the blockchain and cryptocurrency industry, right? Like 2 years ago, you know, they started to crack down on like trading. So you can't like legally in China, you can't like trade fiat currency like yuan into Bitcoin or the other way around. That's restricted, as is like what are called initial coin offerings. So a Chinese entrepreneur can't like print his or her own money and then sell it. This idea of like creating a different kind of Bitcoin also illegal. But Bitcoin itself in China is a digitally protected property. It's kind of, I guess, treated like, I guess, in the eyes of the law, like real estate. So that's kind of where we are now. And there's a lot of theories for why, I guess, the Chinese government hasn't tried to ban possession of Bitcoin. But I think the best theories are that, A, it would make them look weak because enforcement would be like really, really hard. And B, it would just draw like a huge amount of attention to it and then create a black market to it. So I think that the strategy that obviously they've kind of tried to pursue right now is to try and just kind of stay out ahead of Bitcoin, create a competitor, the digital yuan, kind of suck up a lot of the interest from the, like, let's say, startup scene and corporate scene, and divert it to that and just kind of keep people's attention away from Bitcoin. I think that that's kind of what you're seeing right now.
That is kind of, you know, what we're wondering about, because the Chinese Communist Party essentially is now trying to take this idea of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency built on blockchain technology,
mm-hmm.
and kind of create their own version of it. But it,
yes,
but it's different in terms of how it's structured, right? Because you talked about how Bitcoin has this distributed ledger where,
mm-hmm.
You know, you can't really have a central authority because all the transactions have to be verified from all these different nodes. But what's the difference between that and what the Chinese central bank is looking
to create? This is the logical and next part of the conversation. So the difference is not that not in the distributed ledger. The new Chinese currency may very well be on a distributed ledger, meaning the ledger, essentially the Excel sheet that keeps track of transactions, may actually be distributed. There may be one in each province. There may be one at each commercial bank. We would call these essentially nodes, you know, people who help run the network. In Bitcoin, there's like tens of thousands of these, and they're unknown to each other. And that's what kind of makes the network so resistant to attack and fraud, is that it's not possible to kind of seize the network or take control of the network, because the people who sit there and validate transactions are distributed around the world and unknown to each other. In the Chinese digital yuan example, the people who validate the transactions and process them would be very known to each other. They would be controlled by the Communist Party. They would be it would either be completely centrally run by the PBOC, by the central bank, or what the central bank would do would be to, like, and this may happen, take a couple of the biggest banks in China, and they would take Tencent and Alibaba, and like maybe 8 to 12 organizations would run nodes, and they would run the network, and they would share a blacklist. And they would share enforcement rules, and they would share surveillance rules, et cetera. So whereas you can have a distributed ledger when you combine it with like what Bitcoin has, which is like proof of work, where people have to like solve this very hard math problem in order to process transactions, that is very, very different animal than having a distributed ledger where an authority makes the decision about whether a transaction should go through or not. So, I mean, people can think about this as like Bitcoin versus like centralized blockchain. Okay, so the Chinese government is creating a centralized blockchain. It has nothing to do with Bitcoin. It is all about control, surveillance, social engineering. It has nothing to do with censorship resistance or pseudonymity or creating a parallel economy. I mean, these two things couldn't be further from each other.
Right, but I mean, in terms of the terminology, it kind of sounds like what they're doing is creating like a Chinese version of
cryptocurrency. That's the genius of their marketing.
So it's the same name, but it's a totally different concept.
Well, the semantics could be an entirely different podcast, because what is a blockchain is a question we could talk about for hours. I mean, technically speaking, it's just a chain of blocks. To provide color on that, it's literally just a database that has like a series of time-stamped transactions. That's all it is. That's all you could say a blockchain is. There's nothing really beyond that.
So it's kind of meaningless in this sense. Everything can be based on a blockchain, but in terms of the currency.
Right. When we talk about blockchains, the important part is the consensus mechanism. Who decides how the database is updated? And in that case, in the Chinese model for the digital yuan, it's going to be highly centralized. The Chinese Communist Party and its proxies, they will decide how the transactions are handled. Whereas with Bitcoin, no authority is in charge. It is a decentralized process. And that's like the key difference here. However, the Chinese government has been very intelligent. They've kind of seen the like excitement build around this industry. And I call it, they're putting like lipstick on a panoptical pig. They're taking this like word, blockchain, which has a lot of excitement, frontier technology, you know, the next hype cycle, all this stuff. And they're just kind of like grafting it onto this surveillance project. So it is both intelligent, clever, and sort of very dangerous, I would say, very scary.
So you say panoptical pig. So like a panopticon is where you can be watched at all times, right?
Yeah, and previous to these years, today it was not possible technically to have panoptical knowledge over a population. I mean, dictatorships have long tried to keep surveillance over their population, and of course during the Cultural Revolution and in Stasi Germany and in Communist Cuba, we had offline examples of this where it would simply be like families and communities would be recruited to be spies, right? What this new technology is going to allow is the sort of like technical evolution of that, where they don't need to go around and hire like people to be spies, but rather they're trying to make money itself a surveillance mechanism. And this is where this new digital yuan would be even scarier than what the Chinese government has now. So today, if you're the Chinese government and you want to surveil Chris, who's using WeChat, right? Technically speaking, they have to like go through Tencent to get your records, right? Because Tencent has created a settlement system based on the yuan that lives inside the software that they run, which they settle occasionally with banks and the central bank, right?
But I mean, they can still do that today, right? Because they can just tell WeChat, oh, we have a warrant, or whatever. They don't even have to probably use a warrant.
Yes, that's what they do today. So that's what any government would have to do to get the records of anyone using a private bank or a private tech company like a Venmo, PayPal, WeChat, et cetera. The central government has to go get the records. So they have to go through this process. Now, the process is like more annoying in democracies because people and organizations have rights and there's like consumer protection laws. In China, you have the national intelligence law and like that sort of goes out the window. But I don't know. There's probably different opinions on this. Some reporters who live in Beijing that I know actually would contend that like there is a little bit more of a separation of technology and state or banks and state than we may suppose. But let's assume, generally speaking, that separation is less than Western countries, that it's relatively easy for the Communist Party to get the records of people that it wants to get to. Still, they have to go through this process, and it's sort of annoying. What would be way better is if the currency itself was the surveillance mechanism. So they didn't have to deal with Tencent or Alibaba or your private bank in China to get your records. They would just see it on this like single, easily knowable ledger. So every time currency changed hands, whether it be a loan or buying a coffee or a mortgage or purchasing a book or whatever, they would see that. And this goes hand in hand with a war on cash.
Right. So what, before we get to that, ahead. I mean, like, what kind of information with this new digital yuan, what kind of information could they get from
well, it wouldn't be individual? It probably wouldn't be that much different than what WeChat already gathers on you, right? Who are you? How much money did you send? When did you send it? What did you buy? What's your transaction history? What are you likely to buy next? I mean, there's a lot of things you can do with quote unquote AI and big data analysis with regard to your payment history. In fact, your spend says more about you than your words. So if I really want to spy on you, I don't really care about your social media. I care about your bank statement and your credit card statement and your WeChat statement. I want to see what you're spending your money on. That really reveals your true identity to me, right?
Beanie Babies.
I was going to say, if I bought a giant stuffed Winnie the Pooh, then they'd know that I was going to be trouble.
Yeah, exactly. You'd get a big red flag, right? Even if you didn't mention that to anybody else, even your own mother, we would know because you bought it, right? So there is this is of paramount importance to the Communist Party, is having like omniscient financial surveillance over its citizens. And right now it can't do it, right? But if they could get everybody to use this digital yuan where they would control the ledger and at the same time get rid of cash, then they would really get a lot closer to achieving this.
So let me see if I understand this. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the Communist Party is trying to take the same kind of technology that was behind Bitcoin, which was exciting because it was geared towards democracy and liberty. And they're taking this technology and subverting it for an authoritarian purpose.
Pretty much, in a way. I mean, we can interpret it in a variety of ways. But the point is, you can use a distributed ledger, a blockchain, to do many different things. One of those things that you can do is create Bitcoin and separate money from state and give freedom to the people. Another thing you can do with a blockchain is create a much more effective mechanism for control, because the authority behind the blockchain can see all the transactions, right? And they can have a backdoor into everybody's wallet, right? So what they're going to say when they market this thing is that it's going to be much more secure, helpful for consumer protection. It'll be harder
to use by criminals on the dark web.
Exactly. It'll be like such a safe thing, which I think will go really well with their existing marketing. At the end of the day, though, what they're not going to say to you is that, yeah, it'll be safe from like criminals, but it won't be safe from them, right? They'll always be able to confiscate funds, surveil you, freeze payments, go into your wallet and take stuff, or go into your wallet and give stuff. I mean, it may be the kind of thing where, I mean, imagine if there's like a strike of students or something like that, or a strike of auto workers who are angry about wages or something like that. Imagine the power it gives the Chinese Communist Party to just give like the equivalent of $1,000 to all auto workers in a second. And all of a sudden, all those people have like money to get by for the next month or something. It could give them tools to really quell dissent in a way that they don't have now. So it is very effective potentially for them if they can get it to work.
I'm way more scared of them taking away $1,000 than giving me $1,000.
Well, sure, but like what I'm saying is they're going to use this tool to prolong the regime one way or the other. At times that may be financially crushing dissidents and taking away money, At other times, it may be using carrots and incentivizing good behavior. I mean, right now, again, you have to go through this like web of third parties to reward people for good behavior. And there's this all these social engineering experiments going on, a lot of which are overblown and overhyped, but we kind of understand the intentions, right? The point is, like, with if this is rolled out to the level that which they have depicted and revealed in public statements, what their goal is to have, again, not only panoptical surveillance, but like sort of micro control over everybody's transactions. So they could very easily reward patriotical behavior, you know, good revolutionary behavior, in a way that helps the regime survive. I mean, I think that's something you have to consider. Secondly, I just want to help paint this picture. I think this idea that like they're going to replace cash, paper, and metal money with this sort of new base currency is a really important thing to discuss, because I mean, look, from the data we have now, and I'm sure there's like different estimates, different studies, we know that like more than half of all daily transactions inside mainland China are done through social media apps, and about a quarter are done through traditional credit cards and banking services, and about a quarter is still done with cash. This is kind of the official numbers. Now, there's obviously a big parallel economy as well, a big black market economy. So maybe let's say today a third of all transactions in China are still done with cash. That's a lot, and there's a lot going on there. That the government doesn't have control over, which they don't like, right? So this drive and transformation that we've all seen of urban areas, especially in China, going cashless is working in their favor, because what they want is to get rid of cash entirely and replace it with something that's surveillable and controllable, and this is very much within their grasp. So they want to create this like ledger-based currency where they can see every transaction and have control over all of it without needing to deal with third parties. And they want to get it in the hands of everybody and have everybody use it. And this is very much their stated intention, and it's what they want to do. And it's about as far from Bitcoin as you can imagine.
How close are they to doing this?
I mean, they claim that they want to start rolling it out this month. I don't know what that looks like. I mean, if you think back to the way that they marketed and rolled out, or not they, but companies in China, if you think back to the way that WeChat was originally rolled out and marketed, it was done really shrewdly, and the growth was incredible to watch, right? If you just do like a marketing study on how Tencent marketed WeChat, right? I mean, I think the time it took for them to go from like a million users to 10 million users to 500 million users was just like, it's like jaw dropping. So, you know, I think using a combination of like smart marketing, the fact that they're working with companies who already provide platforms and services for people who use, for more than a billion people who use this stuff every day, would give them an ability to on-ramp people on this thing pretty quickly. So what they've said they want to do is mint this currency from the PBOC and then you know, basically give it out to 7 or 8 major parties. So they have like 5 or 6 of the biggest private banks in China plus Tencent and Alibaba, and they want to like work with these people as like founding partners. So you can think of these sort of like an analogy would be when Facebook announced that it's going to come out with its own currency, the Libra, they came out with this like wheel of partners, and it was like 20 different partners ranging from Stripe to Visa to MasterCard that they were like going to work with to roll out the Facebook Libra currency. Well, the Chinese government has its answer in the digital yuan and its partners, and they're going to start with like mainstream mainland China, well-known brands, right, that have a lot of control and a lot of users. So if we're to believe what the central bank is saying, I mean, and the central bank through its, I think, deputy governor is like really outspoken about this, they are moving swiftly on this. They have been working on it for years. It seems like they've been motivated to move faster on it by what Libra is doing. There's a little bit of a space race going on right now between both the Chinese government, Facebook, and the US government with regard to like both like the world's reserve currency in the future and also the currency that people are going to use in the developing world. And I think this has added increased pressure onto the Chinese Communist Party to make sure that they're sort of first. So I think they do want to sort of start rolling this out. I saw a demo, a friend of mine showed me, like, so she's like involved in the banking and cryptocurrency community in China. So she actually showed me a kind of a demo of what it would look like. So I think like what's interesting is like, I guess basically what they're going to do is like within WeChat, like you'll have not only like your bank account linked, but you'll actually get a separate kind of money bucket, which is going to be like the digital yuan. So it'll actually be separate from your bank account. It'll be like a new way to store credits, payments basically. And they're just going to start to just roll this thing out on the payment infrastructure that exists.
Is the digital yuan something that's going to hold value separate from the currency yuan, like the current?
From what we can tell, especially as it begins to be rolled out, it would be pegged in value. So like the existing legacy financial system yuan, which is obviously, you know, vastly inflated in terms of fractional reserve banking and loans and all kinds of derivative products throughout the economy in China. The value of that would, I assume, from what we've been told, it would be the same as the digital yuan, at least in the beginning. But what's really interesting to think about is like in the future, if this thing becomes popularized, and let's say this thing becomes like the standard, I think what the central government is going to be able to do is rein in the power of private banks in China. So, for example, a lot of like we've seen a lot of not a lot, but like some at least spectacular cases of like private bank collapses in China where they've loaned out too much money and they've had bank runs, et cetera. If you kind of just kind of piece this thing together and you follow what their goal is to have omniscient financial surveillance over everyone. Fractional reserve banking may be a thing of the past. Because if you think about it, if the Chinese government gives the digital yuan to like a private bank, and the private bank distributes that currency to clients and customers, that's great. They get to see what the clients and customers are doing. But if the commercial bank takes that and then does fractional reserve banking and issues, you know, loans in amounts greater than that and basically issues these credits, the government won't have surveillance over that. So I think there's sort of a dual intention here to not only surveil and control transactions, but also potentially rein in some of the private banks and kind of centralize things even further. And that's something we're just going to have to follow.
One of the things about Chinese currency is that it's not just staying in China. If you look at like Alipay is mm-hmm. has been aggressively expanding overseas. Even like the local New York bodega, like deli, has a little sign on the window that says "We accept Alipay." Mm-hmm. Alipay is in like 50 countries or something. So, mm-hmm. If this is going to be replaced by a digital yuan, then are we going to start seeing transactions like around the world in this digital Chinese currency?
Yeah, so I think this really neatly fits in with the Belt and Road infrastructure project. So what I would imagine, and again, just from like evidence of what you're describing, you're already seeing WeChat and Alipay all over Africa, Latin America, South Asia, even in Europe and the United States. So there's just like an aggressive expansion here. Now, I think the idea is that like this is the groundwork for then in the next year or two, the government to roll out this digital trackable currency and kind of replace the underlying asset structure of all these different payment networks. So what they could have on their hands in a couple of years if they play this right is not only surveillance and control over all the transactions in China, in mainland China, and again, as they get rid of cash, increasingly tight control and surveillance with very, very little room for people to be dissidents, let's say, or to do anything that the government doesn't want them to do. But you'd also have control in more than 50 countries across South Asia, Africa, Middle East, Latin America, maybe even in Europe, maybe even in parts of the United States. So it's an amazing and brazen and bold plan, and maybe it works. And this is why we have to take what Facebook's doing really seriously. And Zuckerberg sat there in Congress recently and basically was like, hey, it's either us or the Chinese government. And you know what? He's kind of right. I mean, who else besides Facebook has a user base of billions and could boast tens of millions of users in countries as disparate as Nigeria and the Philippines? If there is going to be a way to challenge the digital yuan's expansion and basically beat back the like panoptical financial surveillance state, ironically, it may have to be through Facebook. And it's kind of funny. But you know what? If you actually sit there and think about it, how many governments would you trust as a central banker and as an honest broker of money more than Facebook? I mean, it's not really more than like 25 governments, right? I mean, most governments are dictatorships or authoritarian regimes of some shape or size. A lot of them are horribly corrupt. I mean, I'm sure you'd take the Norwegian money over the Facebook money, or maybe the Australian money. But the list gets thin really fast. And, you know, for a lot of these countries, look, Facebook's going to operate under American and Swiss law. And yes, it'll be a surveillance tool, and we can be concerned about that. But at the end of the day, I mean, it may end up being the American/Western answer to what the Chinese are rolling out. We really haven't seen an alternative. I mean, right now the dollar is the like unit of account for like a lot of these countries, but you know, there is no real way for the US government to control the flow of paper cash. I mean, and there seems to be no plan for the US government to replace paper cash. The Chinese government has done this. They've sat there and they've thought about this and they've said, let's just replace cash with social media, and they're killing it, right? So this is their plan. It could work really well. I mean, it may not work. There may be operational reasons. The economy might collapse, ruining their plans, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a non-trivial chance that they roll this thing out, and within 5 years, most of the world is on this like digital yuan, which is a completely controllable and trackable by the Chinese government. And Facebook may be the only thing that could stand up to it from that perspective.
How do other governments feel about that, though?
Well, look, I think a lot of them haven't thought that far. I think they're like really concerned about telecommunications infrastructure. Obviously, we've seen a lot of this arguing about 5G, who's going to build the 5G networks. But what's sad to see is that even Western governments who may be, you know, who are elected by people who actually are in representative democracies, and these governments are supposed to reflect the will of the people, even in representative democracies in Europe, which are supposed to, which one would guess would have like the most focus on things like privacy and rule of law and things like that, human rights, freedom. Even in these countries, these representative governments are hiring Chinese companies to build the telecommunications infrastructure of the future. I mean, even in England, right? So it's concerning. I mean, they've already thought through this, and a lot of democratic countries have thought through it and concluded that it's fine to allow Huawei to, for example, build 5G infrastructure. So, I mean, why would they, you know, what would make them pause on allowing Chinese companies to help with the digital money infrastructure of the future? I'm not sure. I mean, I think they could kind of slip right in there. I would be concerned about that. So on the one hand, you have like potentially this thing unfolding where the digital yuan gets launched, popularized within China, popularized through expats and Chinese families around the world, and through the Belt and Road scheme, you start to like see its adoption. You may have Facebook launch its currency. I mean, the US government, like, you know, and the European Parliament seem to want to defeat Facebook. This may be a bad idea long term, because if they really crush Facebook and prevent Libra from launching, I mean, what else are people around the world going to use for like a global currency? I mean, it's probably going to be the digital yuan, right? So it may be short-sighted.
Can't America just come up with its own, like, you know, digital dollar?
No, I mean, to be serious here, like, Venezuela has no more telecommunications infrastructure that was built by Venezuelans. It was all built by the Chinese. If you go to Mexico City and go out of the airport, like I did a couple months ago, everything is advertisements for Chinese technology. I mean, a lot of these states have already been captured. So, I mean, you know, I don't think there's going to be indigenous innovation and pushback. I mean, the Chinese infrastructure stuff is too good and too cheap, and these countries don't exactly, if you're looking around the world, it's not exactly like they have like plenty of money and a surplus. I mean, a lot of these countries are withstanding massive protest movements and are trying to like just hold on to power, right? So,
well, let's take Mexico for example. Like, let's say Mexico wants to adopt a digital currency system.
Uh-huh.
You're saying it would have to actually be like, it would be the digital peso, but that's actually digital Chinese yuan underneath.
Well, I think Mexico is a very special case just because it's so close to the United States.
Let's take something else. I don't know, Bolivia or something.
I think Bolivia is a much better example. Yeah, so Bolivia currency, you know, look, they currently enjoy control over their own currency, which helps the government pay for stuff that it wants to do with asking the people, which is a nice perk. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, they've already allowed the Chinese to come in and build all kinds of telecommunications infrastructure. They've already taken on loans and investment to the tune of billions to allow the Chinese government and its proxies to build a lot of the both IT, telecoms, et cetera. I see no reason why they wouldn't, you know, want to adopt to a rising global standard, especially for people like Evo Morales in Bolivia, who are like populist and anti-American. I mean, why wouldn't they want to side with the Chinese?
I can think of one potential problem with that, which is if Bolivia bases its digital currency based on the Chinese yuan, then Bolivia really can't control its own monetary policy anymore. It's basically ceding control of its own monetary policy to China.
I was wondering about that too.
And it's kind of like the European Union, right? Like once all the countries adopt the euro, none of the countries have they don't have monetary policy. Only the central organization has.
I know, and they want to hold on to that power when possible. But how many countries have dollarized? So many. I mean, in reality, right? Because they just have been forced to. So we've seen a dollarization in the developing world.
What I'm saying is
you're going to see a yuanization or whatever you want to call it. So with through the Belt and Road and through the digital yuan, the Chinese government may be able to tip the scales. And when governments are running out of time, basically, no government voluntarily dollarizes. It's like horribly anti-nationalist and totally plays straight into the hands of their opponents. I mean, it's not going to be popular for anybody, except maybe the business class. But like, it's not something that governments like voluntarily say, "Hey, let's dollarize." I mean, they're forced to do it. So when these governments are eventually forced to get off their local currency because it goes to zero, because it becomes useless, like all fiat monies do, they may be forced to adopt this. Now, just to finish the picture, if you have this like kind of new cold currency war happening between dollar-backed technology and yuan-backed technology, which I think we're really vividly starting to see unfold, Bitcoin's kind of like the wild card. It just behaves differently in value than the yuan and the dollar will. It won't be controlled by politicians. It's going to be something that behaves much more like a rare asset like gold or real estate. And over time, people are going to be interested in it. I don't think it's going to be possible long term for the Chinese government to prevent its people from understanding what Bitcoin is. It has no barrier for entry. You don't need a bank account to acquire Bitcoin. You don't need to provide an ID. You can do it pseudonymously. And all you need is internet access. The Chinese government has proven that it's been able to keep people off the internet relatively easily. I mean, there's a lot of people who use VPNs and who access, as you know, forbidden information in different ways. But at the end of the day, like most Chinese, I assume, aren't going to risk their livelihood to find out what happened on 6/4. Like, or at least if they find out about it, they're not going to like go around talking about it. You can control the internet. You can keep people off the open internet. But if people are sitting there, let's say this experiment works out with their digital yuan, which kind of like over time, there's inflation, it's going to decrease in value. Slowly but surely. And they know about this thing called Bitcoin. And this thing is going up year after year after year. It's going to be very hard to keep them away from that. I mean, what's the one thing people really, really value is money and making money. So I do think that at the end of the day, Bitcoin will foil a lot of the plans of these governments to create these like these sort of like supranational global currencies. In the medium to long term, I do think this could even backfire for the Chinese government, because if you do this big like educational campaign about like blockchain over the next couple of years, and in their attempt to get people to use the digital yuan and get people comfortable with it, people are eventually going to learn about Bitcoin. It's kind of like blue pill, red pill. You know, not everybody's going to want to take the red pill, but there's plenty of NEOs out there and plenty of people who are willing to take the risk. And I think it could backfire in the end. And, you know, maybe this whole thing is with Xi Jinping and all these speeches and all this media about blockchain, and it could end up being one big Trojan horse. But that's kind of like a a possible silver lining in the future. Short term, I'm very concerned. I think it's massively problematic for civil liberties, for human rights. If properly launched and implemented, this thing will give the Chinese government control and surveillance over its own population and abroad populations that are part of Belt and Road, and even in Western societies, a level of control that no dictator has ever even dreamed of.
Well, I certainly like the Matrix reference, but let me ask you this. Why isn't Bitcoin the rival to a digital Chinese yuan? Like, why would you rely on Facebook Libra when Facebook is a private company that's very interested in doing business in China? That seems like a huge risk.
Yeah, I'm trying to be descriptive here. I mean, I have my own opinions about what I'd like to see happen. I think in the near term, it's very much going to be a space race between China and the United States. And I'm using Facebook as what I think the U.S. has as far as like best chance at popularizing across the world is Facebook and its 2 billion users. So I really think you're going to have Libra, which at the end of the day is probably, I mean, you've seen the reports that what is the Libra? It'll be pegged to the dollar and the euro and the Singaporean dollar and all these things. But I think it's safe to assume that in the end, you know, the Libra currency, if it launches, will basically be a dollarized asset. And then you'll have the digital yuan. Bitcoin is very much at the beginning of its life cycle. It is something that maybe, as far as we know, best estimates, 40 to 50 million people have interacted with or learned about in a significant way. That's less than 1% of the world population. It could take 5, 10, 15 years for this thing to get to the point where, you know, companies and governments have to seriously consider it as like a native payment network. So that's why I'm saying short term, this is really concerning and people should learn as much as they can about what China's doing. And certainly other governments will try and copy it. I just think at the end of the day, the two rivals with the strongest claim to the throne will be China and the United States. I'm projecting that the US will probably be through a software company like Facebook, and Libra seems to be a reasonably attractive you know, a way for the US to achieve that. But at the end of the day, yeah, I'm pretty excited about Bitcoin. I think it's going to separate money from state, and it's going to make these kind of designs and these kind of control mechanisms that governments would have over their people not possible. So in the future, I'm talking 20, 30, 40 years from now, I do think Bitcoin becomes ultimately this sort of global reserve currency, and people end up having a lot more sovereignty over their wealth. And things like authoritarianism and war get a lot more expensive and hard to do. And I think the world would be a better place. But in the meantime, it's going to be a wild ride.
In other words, what you're saying is buy Bitcoin now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an investment advisor, but I would certainly encourage you to invest your time in Bitcoin. Learn about it. I'll be shameless. I wrote a book about Bitcoin this summer. It is currently being translated into Chinese, so that'll be available soon. It's called The Little Bitcoin Book. You can get it on Amazon in both English and Spanish, and we're working on a whole bunch of other translations. I wrote it in conjunction with a bunch of other people from around the world, from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, from former Soviet Union. We wanted to write a book about what is Bitcoin and how will it change the world for like the average smart person, let's put it that way, for the curious mind. Most of the books about Bitcoin out there today are for coders or technical people. So we wanted to write something that you could kind of digest on a short plane ride. It's only about 100 pages, but we feel like it does an effective job. So that's my effort, is to try and do things like that, publish and speak about this topic more widely so people can kind of gain their own curiosity about it. And my main advice is to invest your time in it, because even if the economics of it are up and down over the next couple of years, you being an expert in this area is going to be very useful for you, whether it's in your family, company, nonprofit, media outlet. Like, you're going to want to be like the Bitcoin pro, let's put it that way. It'll be very helpful for you as we move into this new area. And I also think that like folks like you, who are like really incisive political, social commentators, and human rights groups more broadly, are going to start to be forced to think more about economics and finance. It's just going to be such a critical part of how everything works. I mean, it already obviously is, but what I've noticed, and it's been really surprising to me, is that at least in the human rights world, and the activists that you've met at the Oslo Freedom Forum are no are no exception. You know, we don't really talk about currency and money and the way payments are made and things like that. It's not part of the narrative you hear on the Oslo Freedom Forum stage. It's not something that is seen as part of the human rights movement. And I think that's a mistake, because if you actually interview people about their daily troubles and struggles, one of them is, you know, almost certainly, if you actually ask them about it, well, it's hard to get paid. Well, how do you get paid? Well, I have to like have people wire this thing to my account, and oftentimes it gets frozen or delayed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you actually ask people, currency and money and banking is a big stumbling block for both journalists and for human rights activists, but it's not really on the agenda. A great example of this is my friend Ivan Mwire, who you all met at probably several Oslo Freedom Forums by now, who's an opposition leader in Zimbabwe. And I asked Ivan, I said, hey, do you want to come make a presentation in San Francisco about hyperinflation, which your country experienced? And he lived through his currency. In 1980, the Zimbabwean dollar was worth $2. It was really strong currency. And he lived through Robert Mugabe single-handedly essentially destroy the currency and vaporize it to where in 2008 they were printing $100 trillion notes, Zimbabwean dollar notes. So he was like, sure, I've never talked about that before. And then he whips out during the panel discussion after we brought him to San Francisco. He apparently wears around his neck a Zimbabwean dollar from 1980. And he's like, we use this as a symbol of what our economy used to be. And I was like, wow, that would have been really cool to know, right? So I think the economics and currency stuff and the finance stuff is something that's going to become kind of more required reading and more important for all of us, in whether we are, like you guys, China watchers, political commentators, human rights activists, investigative journalists. This is going to be more of something that we're going to have to kind of absorb. And I think this big sort of Chinese push to create a digital currency to compete with Facebook and the US dollar and the rise of Bitcoin will make it quite vivid and relevant for all of us. But at the end of the day, yeah, I would invest your time in Bitcoin. That's my main piece of advice.
Well, so if somebody does want to learn more about you and your writings on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, where can they go?
Yeah, so first you can follow me on Twitter. It's my last name, Gladstein, Gladstein. You can also check out the book that I wrote with a bunch of other Bitcoin experts. It's called The Little Bitcoin Book. Why Bitcoin Matters for Your Freedom, Finances, and Future. And it's available on Amazon and in other resellers. It's also available in Spanish. You can get it on Kindle, paperback, or audiobook. So we're trying to evangelize. If you really want something, if you're really lazy and you only have like 20 minutes or 10 minutes, I also wrote a Time magazine article about a year ago called Why Bitcoin Matters for Freedom, which is like, let's say, the 800-word edition of why this is relevant and interesting.
Alex also just published an op-ed in Bitcoin Magazine called In China, It's Blockchain and Tyranny versus Bitcoin and Freedom. So I recommend everyone check that out as well.
Yeah. Well, anything else you guys wanted to touch on or dive into?
No, I think that was a pretty good roundup. I'm terrified. Who else is?
Oh, I'm also terrified.
Definitely freaked out.
Okay, you should be terrified, but you should also be excited. I hope there's a little bit of intrigue and excitement. I mean, here's the thing. The Chinese government can't control Bitcoin, can't control the price, can't prevent people from getting on. It's kind of cool. It's like, how Hollywood is it that the one thing that could actually probably challenge the Communist Party and maybe even in the end bring it down is like a magical internet money that was created by we don't even know who. It's like the perfect freaking movie plot line, right?
Right. Well, I'm excited because I bought Bitcoin back when it was around 3,000, so... As long as you're right in your prediction, then I'm excited.
I have pretty deep conviction that money that the government can't control is something that humans are going to want in an increasingly dire way moving forward. That would be my like human rights take on it.
I definitely was thinking that there probably is more than one Communist Party official who owns some Bitcoin.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, like, in a huge way. I mean, what we know for sure is that high-ranking officials, what they do is they take their money, they buy hydroelectric equipment, and they either set up a dam on one of the many large rivers in Western and Southwestern China, And they either build a dam and then they attach Bitcoin mining equipment, or they just buy the Bitcoin mining equipment and they attach it, and they get like really subsidized electricity, right? Cheap electricity, which in some cases the government subsidizes because they want, in a very sinister way, they want the Han Chinese to come in and do economic work out there while pushing out the Tibetans and Uyghurs, right? They want to like kind of Han sort of sinicize the whole region. This is something we know they do. And when you mine Bitcoin, when you actually mine a new Bitcoin block, so miners every 10 minutes, 12 and a half Bitcoin come into the world. And these are essentially pure Bitcoin. They have no background in terms of where they came from. They're called like virgin Bitcoin. Like it's impossible to track this new Bitcoin. So what they can do is they can mine Bitcoin. They get this 12 and a half Bitcoin into their account from their Hydro project. They can move it wherever they want. They can move it into any wallet, and they can very easily get their capital out of China. So this is what quite a few of these folks have done, whether they be in the Communist Party or just kind of in the elite. One of the other reasons why the Chinese government maybe hasn't banned possession of Bitcoin is because too many of them are doing this and then using it to get wealth across the capital controls.
Oh, jeez.
Well, thank you for joining us, Alex. That was an exciting podcast.
My pleasure. Sorry to scare you off, but hopefully you have an inkling that there's something out there that can actually challenge what Beijing is doing and fluster them. And maybe Satoshi Nakamoto will make Xi Jinping look silly in the far future.
That would be great. Thanks again for joining us, Al. Take care. And to everyone.
My pleasure.
Oh, yeah. And to everyone listening, thanks for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshta.
Talk to you next time.